Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, Fred Obiero.
Hello, and welcome to the Ivy Podcast. My guest today is Simon Mass. He is the founder and CEO at the Condo Store Group of Companies. Thanks for joining us, Simon.
Thank you for having me, Fred.
Before we start this episode, I have one small request to our listeners. As we continue to grow the Ivy Podcast, we will greatly appreciate it if you would just take a minute of your time to leave us a review on the show, because reviews make a huge difference to podcast channels like ours. Now, time for the episode with Simon. Simon, I want to delve into your background a little bit. You've been involved in real estate, wealth management, and nonprofit consulting, just to say the least. Why don't you share with the audience a little bit about your background and your role as CEO?
Well, I'll try to keep it brief because it's been an interesting ride. I fell into the real estate sector quite by accident. I had done my undergraduate degree in engineering and management in the UK. And when I graduated in 1991, if anyone that's listening is old enough, they'll know that there was a major global recession at that time. And I traveled to Canada, to Toronto, actually, to do an MBA while waiting for the recession to obviously pass. During my time as a student doing my MBA in Canada, I fell into real estate. Again, like I said, purely by accident, by being lost in a very, very bad snowstorm. And the only way I could figure out how to get back home was to stop at a sales center that was, in those days, was really just a trailer, to go in and ask for directions. Lo and behold, the lady that was in the trailer was a very, very nice older sales lady. She insisted I shouldn't be driving in a snowstorm, and she basically gave me a very nice 2-hour one-on-one brief tutorial on the pre-construction condominium sector. Fast forward a few weeks, I decided with the very small savings I had from my undergraduate years when I was working part-time while going through school, to really take a risk, a massive leap of faith, and put every penny I had into a number of condo units and just see what happens while I was in school. And that's really, in a nutshell, what happened. Several years later, after graduating, that very small amount of money that I put out there, which was a lot of money for me at that time, I was in my early 20s, ended up giving me a 7-figure profit. And I decided that if there was ever a sign from God on getting into a sector or into an industry, that was that sign. And I jumped all in. I graduated from my MBA and set up a company immediately and started investing in real estate.
I have to ask, how did you go from asking for directions to this old lady to getting a 2-hour tutorial on investments? How did that topic come about?
Well, it was a sales center for a pre-construction condo site on the waterfront in downtown Toronto. So when I was in there, you know, I've always been very curious anyway. I started asking what was going on, what the deal was, what she did. And she hadn't spoken to anyone, I think, in days because of the storm. She was stuck in this trailer. So she had a captive audience. And she was more than happy to fill me in. And like any other good salesperson, I mean, at the time, like I said, I was in my early 20s. She must have been in her late 60s. She was looking for a sale. And you know what? She did really well. She took a complete stranger, and within a week or two, she had me in multiple transactions with her company. So she, you know, ultimately, she did an incredible job.
That is wonderful. That's a fascinating story. What are some of the latest trends in real estate that you are currently researching that will reshape the global real estate industry? Please share any examples that you may have.
Well, you know, investing as a whole sector, whether it's real estate, stocks, bonds, private equity, whatever it is, it really comes down just to fundamentals, right? So as an investor, you have to be able to take the information, digest it, and see if it works within, you know, your own universe. So in our industry, in real estate development, and in a city like Toronto, like, I don't know if a lot of the listeners are aware, but Toronto is and has been the number one or the number two city in the world in regards to the number of cranes that are up and running. So our real estate sector is by large one of the most successful ones globally. And it's been on a 27 to 28 year run. And what I mean by that is even during the 07, 08 global crisis, Toronto was one of the only cities in the world that did not get affected by having a crash in its real estate sector. All that really happened was that the real estate developers put everything on hold for literally 12 months. And, you know, they took a hiatus. A year after that hiatus, they came back even stronger with a higher pricing model than pre-recession. And if we fast forward now to the current global crisis that we have, which in its own way is very similar to a global recession, you know, the pandemic right now, Toronto again is one of the rare cities in the world where the real estate sector, pre, during, and post right now are at one of the strongest levels ever. And, you know, both you and I are right now in Florida, so we both realize that's also happening on a grand scale in Florida as well.
Right.
So
what I was going to say, and sorry to interrupt, you talk about Toronto has the highest number of cranes that are actively being utilized worldwide. What do you think is the reason behind that? Could that be because it was underdeveloped, or would, I'm curious to know why that is, because I would have not, never guessed that. I would have guessed some, you know, something maybe in China because there's a lot of development going on there.
Sure. I mean, Canada's a country that is generally on the economics front driven by a very, very strong immigration program that the government promotes. So, you know, I'm one of those immigrants. You know, I basically came from another country to study and to become a resident and a citizen, and obviously ended up staying, set up my own company, hired people, et cetera. You know, we're all working in that realm together. But Canada was always fairly underdeveloped. I mean, if you look on a map and see the size, the mass scale of this country, and then look at the population numbers, Canada's population hovers around, I believe, 34 million. And Florida's, if I'm not wrong, is what, 26, 27 million? So
that's incredible.
You know, the entire country has a little bit more in terms of population than we have in the state of Florida. And there is so much land. You know, it's a country with four seasons. It's a country that encourages entrepreneurs and immigrants to really basically come in and be a part of a nation. So for that reason, Canada has become a safe haven for many countries around the globe, in particular, the Asia region, where immigration numbers have for the last 30 years been one of the highest. We also have a lot of immigrants coming in from the Middle East and Europe now. So the country literally takes on about 500, 600,000 new immigrants annually. And about 50% of those new immigrants that are coming in and settling in Toronto. So Toronto has a need for housing that is not easily met, even though we have so many cranes. What's important to note, to answer your question in a roundabout way, is you always look at countries' real estate markets, and you should really be looking for those fundamentals. And one of them is vacancy rate in buildings. So when you mentioned China, I'm sure somebody can come back and spin it that obviously China's real estate market is on another level compared to the United States or Canada because of the volume of construction. But the reality of it is, you can have volume of construction, but then have empty buildings, which we refer to as, you know, ghost buildings or even ghost cities. And they're all across China, by the way. I mean, there's been documentaries about entire cities where there's no one living in them, but there are shopping malls that don't have any retail tenants. And there are literally 50 to 100 condo towers and communities with nobody living in them. The difference with Toronto is we have a pre-pandemic, we had a less than 1% vacancy rate in the rental market. And post-pandemic, we're around 3%. So that means even during a pandemic that has gripped the entire world for the last 15 to 18 months, there's only 3% vacancy for anyone that's looking to rent a property in Toronto right now. So that goes to show you that there are real people moving into the city and there's a real demand for people for housing. And that's one of the most important things to know about why Toronto and Canada continue to have such a successful real estate market.
Very helpful how you were able to tie the theory on the immigration into Canada and how that impacts the housing market. I think that helps paint the picture of as to why, like you said, Canada having the largest number of active cranes in the construction site. Moving on, the condo store has over $24 billion in investments. How do you go about identifying ideal investment opportunities that align with your corporate strategy?
Well, that's a great question. And I'm going to answer in different segments, but Canada, again, I'll just work with Toronto because that is our core market. So in Toronto on an annual basis, there's about 150 brand new developments being launched. And most of these developments are high rise. So they're large condominium complexes. So when you have about 150 condo projects being launched annually, of course, there's going to be a percentage of them that are in the downtown core and a large percentage of them that will be in the outskirts or in smaller little townships. So for us, the initial analysis is finding projects that we feel will give our investors, our clients, the best rate of return. And that doesn't necessarily mean that every single one of them has to be in the downtown core, you know, next to our sports stadiums or next to the biggest and best malls. It's all about figuring out what the dynamics are in the rental market and the resale market. So I'll tell you this. On an annual basis, we probably cherry pick 6 to 10 projects that we would like to invest in. And on average, we end up making a deal on about 4 projects a year. So that's 4 out of 150 plus launches. So we're very specific on where we want to invest our money. And the reason for that is A, good business. We don't want to be promoting and being a sales and marketing company with no real integrity in what the final results are. But equally as important, my partner, John Mellenbacher, and I are our clients' largest, our firm's largest clients. So we're investing side by side into every project with our own clients. And again, we're the largest clients of the firm. So obviously, if we're going to be putting our own hard-earned money in a very large scale into these 4 projects a year, we want to make sure that we've done everything possible to be able to invest our money wisely and obviously the money of our investors who have been trusting us for over 20 years now with their hard-earned money.
That's a very selective process, but it goes to show how the amount of due diligence that you guys put in place in order to be able to manage these large funds and be successful while doing that.
For sure, for sure. You know, it's not about the number of deals that we do on an annual basis. It's about doing the right deals. And there are years that have passed where we've done maybe one single deal in an entire year. And then there's years where we've done more. So we're only interested in doing deals where we feel that it's a win-win. And this also goes into play with our negotiations with developers. I mean, we try to work with some of the country's largest development companies because we want to be involved with projects that, you know, go from cradle to grave. In any city, anywhere in the world, there's always a percentage of projects that fail. They could be failing because they don't achieve enough pre-sales to go to construction, or they could get all of those pre-sales very, very early, but the group that is putting the deal together, the developer, are not experienced enough to be able to have the follow through and complete a project. So Right. It's so important not only to pick the right project, but to also pick the right developer, because ultimately we are going to be partners with that developer up until the day that we are handed over the units and given the keys and we become the actual owners of those units. So it's really important to be able to pick winners and not to be like many, many people in this sector, not to be a sales or marketing company. And there is absolutely nothing wrong with being a salesperson or a broker or a realtor that promotes and sells everything, but that is not the business that we are in.
That's a good distinction to make. Now, I want to talk about competition. The internet has increased global competition, not just in the investment and real estate industries, but in all types of businesses. What has been your philosophy on the right approach to winning competitive deals?
I think ultimately integrity and follow through and general business ethics in an industry where there is a lot of money involved and huge profits has allowed us to build our brand and our reputation, not only with our own clients, but generally speaking in the entire industry. And that's evident in the fact that we normally commentate maybe 20 to 30 times a year with local media sources on the sector and not on a project. So that's really important for us. The other factor that's really important, especially because, you know, it's to do with global awareness and the internet. I think it's really easy over the last 7 or 8 years for the consumer to be taken advantage of with internet marketing, where copycat artists or people that don't really know what they're doing are casting a huge net, right? To be able to capture a very small percentage of people to be able to make that sale. And we've tried and we try to work with industry regulators to constantly try to up that game and make the barrier of entry a little bit higher. And over the last 24 months, actually in Canada, to become a real estate broker, agent, realtor, whichever one of those phrases you want to use for that sector, they've started putting into place educational requirements that they didn't have before. You know, 2-3 years ago, as long as, I don't even think you needed to actually have a high school education, as long as you were able to basically fill out an online application and complete 3 courses, you could become a licensed agent. Which is you know, quite dangerous, because real estate for most people, you know, for 99% of the population, it's the largest and the biggest investment they're going to make in their life.
Yeah.
And to hand that investment over to somebody that's, you know, is really holding a license, but for that consumer not to know how easy it is to get that license, is a dangerous, you know, place to be for consumers. So over the last 24 months in Ontario, which is our province, which is equivalent to like Florida being a state here, an undergraduate degree has become a requirement to be able to become an agent. But look, it takes a lot for anyone that has a successful business or a successful career to be able to get to where they're at. And, you know, for a lot of people that don't know how much effort there is. They think that you're an overnight success, but you know, I've been doing this now for 30 years, and under the condo store, we just recently celebrated our 15th year anniversary right in the middle of COVID. It's
wonderful. Congratulations,
it's,
by
thank,
the way.
Thank you. It's, you know, it's 30 years in the business and 15 years under our brand, the condo store. It's taken a lot of effort, a lot of sleepless nights, and it still ends up being an 80-hour week even today. So we're lucky to be where we are, but there's also so much effort that's required to maintain what we have, especially with the amount of competition that's out there in this sector in particular.
One follow-up that I have based on what you said about the Canadian requirements for real estate folks is, let's say you're an American-based company and you want to branch out into Canada. Will their real estate employees also need to get those same qualifications to operate there, or is it only limited to the Canadians?
Well, I think if you want to become a realtor, you're going to have to do the equivalent licensing exams, whether you're coming from Toronto to, let's say, from Toronto to Florida, or vice versa. It's not that difficult to do, but quite frankly, you know, if you're a realtor in Miami and you're successful, you're probably not going to want to be a realtor in Toronto. And real estate agents and brokers as a whole have a referral program that they work with. And it's industry-wide that spans from state to state or country to country. So you don't really, you know, let's say you're a realtor in Toronto that has a lot of clients that are interested in being in Miami. You basically have to connect with a Miami broker and set up a peer-to-peer referral program with one another so that the other person basically handles the client in the other country or
right.
in the other
and that's good because you'll be referring them to someone that you know is qualified and knows how to handle successful investments, especially like you said, where when people make investments into real estate, that's probably the biggest investment they've ever made in their life, and you want to make sure that whoever's helping them from a professional standpoint on that is someone that is supremely qualified.
Exactly.
And that's important.
It's very, very important. And, you know, just for our own business, for example, we're obviously a Canadian company with a U.S. division, but our U.S. division, like for the last 7 or 8 years, we've been working with one of the largest brokerage firms in the United States, Elliman. So the Douglas Elliman Group. And we have a relationship with them. And again, when it comes to other parts of the world, we have a relationship with their strategic alliance partner, which is Knight Frank, which is also one of the largest real estate brokerage firms in the world with over 500 locations internationally. So we try to align ourselves with much larger players than ourselves so that we can maintain, the trust of our clients and also the integrity of the overall business model.
Earlier, you and I were talking about COVID and the impact it's had before we started recording this. So the world is slowly getting back to a state of normalcy after the COVID-19 pandemic. And there may be people that are in the process of either switching careers, in some instances, into real estate. What recommendations do you have on how to break into and be successful in the real estate industry?
Well, I'm not going to give you any secrets. But, you know, like any other business, you need to be slightly different, and you need to also find a niche or an angle that basically allows you to stand out from the crowd. You know as well as I do, Florida has a massive number of realtors that are licensed.
Right.
But the truth of it is, just like in any other, I would say, generally speaking, any other sales career, only a very small percentage of all of the people in that sector are the ones that are actually making the largest percentage of the money. So whether you're in insurance or real estate sales or car sales, you know, it's really the top 5% that make 95% of the revenue of the profits in that sector. So I think you need to be good at what you do. And it sounds a little bit simple when I put it that way, but you can't get into this sector thinking that it's a hobby or just saying, you know, feeling that you like real estate. Well, you know, most people like real estate. Most people like cars. It doesn't mean you're going to be the best realtor or you're going to be an incredible salesperson in the car business. You need to bring a lot more to it to be successful. Plus, don't forget, for anyone that's looking to get into a career in real estate, you're getting into a sector where it's highly competitive and the barrier to entry is fairly low. So unless you're coming into it with a real strategy, it's not going to be a fun ride. And, you know, pick 10 realtors that may be within your circle of influence, friends, family. And I will guarantee you out of those 10, 8 of them are not successful on any level, or they're not even working as a realtor because they went through the licensing. They realized how difficult it was to acquire a client, whether it was for buying or selling. And then obviously, like most things, you know, people give up when they don't have quick success.
And that's the thing. Everyone has this expectation that, oh, it's going to be easy. The housing market is booming. This is the time to be a realtor. But it's like you said, you got to put in the time. You just talked about even now, you're putting in 80 hours and 30 years in. So that just gives a perspective of it's never easy. It never will be easy, especially if you want to achieve high levels of success.
It's, you know, it's never easy anyway to be an entrepreneur or to have a startup. It never is. But I can tell you, I'm personally putting in more hours now than I did when I started. And that's because the machine is so big that it constantly requires your day-to-day attention.
Right.
And if you don't give it that attention, unless you have an incredible middle and upper management team, which in itself, you know, is a massive expense. Unless you're in that sector, you as an owner operator, whether you have 20 employees or if you're at a number that we are, where at times we're over 100, you have to be operating the business yourself and be on it hands on daily. And that's what also makes you successful. The reason our client base have loyalty to us is that they're always able to touch base with myself or my partner as owners. We haven't disappeared. We're not hard to get a hold of. We don't screen our calls or not reply to emails. We're there. And again, in the same way that our clients love that, the developers that we partner with and we make arrangements and relationships with, they like the fact that they're also dealing with the owners of the company versus middle management.
So this next question, it relates to something that I saw about you that I found really intriguing. A large portion of your career has been about charity, which is extremely impressive. You know, the condo store is a corporate donor and in some cases a sponsor to organizations such as UNICEF, Habitat for Humanity Canada, the Serge Ibaka Foundation. Serge Ibaka is an NBA player for those who may not be familiar. What made you so passionate about giving back to the community? And what strategies can you share with other leaders on how to embrace charitable efforts and make them part of their corporate DNA?
Well, I would say that it's a very humbling introduction to this part of what we do. And it's been about 7 years where we've really taken on this responsibility, and we haven't taken it on lightly in any way. We just believe that when there's success, personally, on a business level, you should give back. It's really as simple as that. You have to give back to your community and to people around you that are less fortunate, especially for the fortunate ones like us that are in a sector that, like I said, right at the beginning of this discussion, it's 27 years. We've gone through recession, we've gone through a pandemic, and the business is still booming. The industry is growing at a phenomenal rate, and there's no slowdown really anticipated. So you have to really take that into your mind to know that you're very, very lucky. And for us, look, a large portion of our client base are in the medical community. So, you know, I'd say 75% of our investors, our clients, are doctors, surgeons, physicians, dentists. So we see how hard they work. We appreciate, and because many of our clients are now personal friends. So these are people that came on board 20 years ago, and we still have the same clients from 20 years ago that over these two decades have been referring their friends, family, and colleagues to us. Because one thing we didn't touch on earlier was that as a company, generally speaking, we don't advertise. Pretty much all of our client base, our investor base, has come strictly from referrals. So when we look at those clients that have gone through 10 years plus of schooling, that start their careers, you know, doctors typically start their careers in their 30s. Whereas for the rest of us, you know, whether we studied engineering or went to business school, you know, we're ready to be in the workforce by the age of 23 or 24. So right. Dealing with people that really have sacrificed an extra, I would say, 6 to 10 years of their lives to go and do good. And, you know, in Canada in particular, very, very different to the United States, doctors and surgeons make a living, but they don't make the type of income that they make here. It's totally different salary ranges. So these doctors, these clients, they're supporting our business, and we organically fell into supporting the hospitals and the foundations that they are a part of, and we're continuing to do that. We generally do this in Toronto, but we've done it also internationally with certain charities as well. So whether it's, you know, youth development, whether it's, you know, a new cancer ward at our local hospital, or as you mentioned, like, you know, if a basketball player that plays for our team has an event, whatever it may be, we'd like to get connected to as many of these as possible. But obviously there's a limitation. There's only so much that you can do, but we're growing that part of our business. Philanthropy for John and I is very, very important. Just in the last year, we decided to set up university scholarship programs for three of the major universities in Ontario and Toronto.
And that's wonderful.
And we're growing that. And most recently, we've started conversations with and are entering into I would say like a donation program with Sea Shepherd, which is an incredible organization that's been around and founded by Captain Paul Watson, who used to be one of the original founders of Greenpeace. And we're working with, I feel like I'm plugging charities, but I mean, this is if there was anything good to plug, it's charities. But
exactly.
We're also working with another incredible charity that just before I came on this call with you, I received an email with them that we're going to be officially launching something soon. It's called Lonely Whale.
Wonderful. That's great. Congratulations on that.
Great charity that deals with, you know, a fundamental issue that's going around the world right now to do with plastics in the ocean and what it's doing to our marine wildlife. So if anyone is really interested to learn more about us, if you end up going on our website, please, if there's only one section that you focus on, focus on the section to do with philanthropy and the charities and see if there's any way that you can connect with them and help them.
Wonderful. Last question before I let you go. I know you have a very tight schedule. What has helped you get to where you are, and what of advice would you give to someone that wants to pursue a career that's similar to yours? I know you've mentioned, you know, bits and parts of this throughout this discussion, but just to wrap it up.
Well, I think taking risks is extremely important, and taking those risks when you're young is really what you need to focus on. So like when we're discussing stuff with mentorship programs at universities, I'm always trying to put it out there that don't be so conservatively minded when you're, you know, in your early 20s. If there was ever a time for you to really feel free and try something different and take some chances and take some risks, it's at that time. But overall, whatever career that anyone is looking to get into, and if anyone's looking for any advice, I think you just need to really find your angle, find your groove, figure out what your niche is and dive into it. Because I love what I do, and that's why I'm able to put in 80-hour weeks without complaining to anyone about it, or for feeling negative that I'm not able to do what I want to do with my life because of my work schedule. So I like what I do. Whether, you know, I could have fallen into many, many other sectors, but generally speaking, it would have had a fundamental core sales, marketing, investments, degree of involvement. So for me, I've fallen into the right niche that works for me, but I enjoy, you know, relationships. I enjoy always being open and hungry for the next deal, because I have friends around me that are always wondering why I'm still doing what I'm doing. And it really doesn't come down to money. As a business, obviously we like to be successful and we like to be profitable and we like to make money. And we like to do that for our clients, of course, because that's our core fundamental. But the fact is we do what we do because we like it. And I think for anyone that's looking to pursue a career, even though at the age of 18, 19, or early 20s, it could be kind of difficult to try to figure out what you like, you're going to have an inkling of what you gravitate to. So I think people should, you know, take that risk and go towards something that they really feel that they have a desire for versus the safe bet. And that safe bet has always been, as you know, for most people that are studying, about to go to university, it's the typical careers of being a doctor, a lawyer, or an accountant, because they're safe. But there's lots of other careers where you can, you know, utilize those educational tools that you learn in those fields to be able to set up a business for yourself and just have a much more satisfying life.
Take some risks. Don't be conservatives. Those are wonderful pieces of advice. Simon, thank you so much for taking your time to talk to us today. This has been very fascinating.
Thank you, Fred. We had a lot of fun today. So look forward to talking to you again soon.
All right. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Ivy Podcast. Please take a moment to rate, review, and subscribe on your preferred podcast listening platform. We really appreciate that effort. Until next time.